Crimewire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crimewire team, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, and Susan Murphy Milano, a violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime and the top of their game. Crimewire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during tonight's show by dialing 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the Crimewire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. As you know, my friend and co-host Susan Murphy Milano has been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and will be off for the next several weeks while she undergoes treatment. You can show your support for Susan and keep up with her progress by visiting her site at www.conqueringcancer.me. And I must say, for those who are following Susan's situation, you really should go to that site, conqueringcancer.me, and check the entry from September 19th. And Susan's at a critical stage in her treatment. She's undergoing chemo and preparing for surgery. And she's had no income for several months now, and she has no health insurance. So anybody who is a fan of Susan's or just wants to be a good Samaritan, I encourage you to go to the conqueringcancer.me site and see if you can assist. And if you're unable to assist financially, your prayers for Susan are most welcome. My first guest tonight is former Gambino Crime Family Associate Andrew DiDonato. Andrew, welcome to Crimewire.
Hey, Dennis, how you doing, pal? Thank you for having me.
Good. Nice to talk with you again.
No, without a doubt. I haven't heard from you all summer. You're a busy man. Heard you were out fishing all summer.
Out catching the lunkers.
Hey, good. I'm glad.
Now, Andrew, let's catch up, if we can, on some of what's been going on with you. But first, I just want to give a little more background for people who are not familiar with you or your history. You started, you were doing street crimes at, you were about 14, I believe, and you were into some, you know, more minor type things, stealing the radios out of cars and tires and hubcaps, that type of stuff. And then you weren't affiliated with any organized crime crew at that point. But within a couple of 3 years, you came to the attention of a crew of the Gambino crime family. It was run by a capo or a captain named Nicky Carrazzo. Can you tell us a little bit about how all that came about and about who Nicky Carrazzo is?
Well, that just came about the neighborhood setting, Dennis. You know, I grew up in the neighborhood where it was predominantly a lot of Gambino crime family activity. A lot of my friends and kids that I grew up with, you know, had uncles and, you know, fathers and friends that were already associated with the Gambino family. And I myself was involved with criminal activity with guys that were already answering to the Nicholas Carrazzo faction of the Gambino crime family. And that's how I got associated with Nicky. And through my criminal activity, my name kept coming up in the circle of friends that I had. And then Nicky started to be aware of my activity. And then he invited me to the club, and the rest is history from that point on. I was very young at the time when that did happen. And, you know, Nicky was a very high profile guy. You know, he was, I would say, to the book on organized crime rules and regulations, this guy was a gangster when he woke up, a gangster when he went to sleep, you know, and 24/7, this guy was in character.
So a gangster's gangster, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, basically, you know, when I think back on it years ago, you know, you didn't even realize the capacity of the people, you know, that I was involved with, you know. You know, back then, you don't realize it. These are just guys that are at your immediate grasp. You know, these are the people who, you know, you look to and, you know, that you go to when you had something to bring to their attention, whether it be stolen goods or anything like that, never knowing that the relationship was just going to evolve the way that it did. And then from that point on, I was involved in the criminal activity day and night, day and night, day and night, up until my, you know, until my adult years. You know, it never stopped. That's what I was going to be. I was going to be involved in organized crime. That was it.
And you, and not just you, but you and your associates for the Carrazzos and for other organized crime families and crime family crews, did a lot of different things, right? I mean, it wasn't just one type of crime. You guys did almost anything and everything there was to do to make money.
Yeah, whatever it was. I mean, you know, it's like anything else. You know, you network, so whatever's the easiest thing to do at the time where, you know, you could tap into a resource to make some money, that's the way it was. You know, if a guy came around and he had some, you know, some hot credit cards or something like that, next guy's got a few orders for some auto parts that need to be stolen, next guy comes to you and there's a stick-up or something like that, it was just, you know, you were always looking for the edge to prove yourself. You were always looking for the edge to produce for the higher-ups. I mean, basically, that's how it works. It's all about money, as you know, Dennis, and, you know, that's how it works. You know, the person who earns gets noticed. The person who earns, you know, he gets included in doing other things, usually when he shows the capacity to be able to do such work.
And Andrew, is it safe to say that in the world of organized crime, you're only as good as your last earn? I mean,
yeah, without a doubt, that's exactly organized crime, exactly how it is, Dennis. You know that. You know that old song and dance. I mean, I'm not the only one. I was just one of many. You know, many guys in my neighborhood who threw their lives away at a very young age, thinking that they were going to be a part of something great. And, you know, today you're riding high, you know, you're earning, you're doing this. But like anything else, it has its highs and lows. And when it goes into the lows, you realize how expendable you are and how the next guy who's doing A, B, and C, how he's ingratiated with the boss's ear and everything like that. And, you know, today you're smiled upon, tomorrow you're frowned upon. That's just the way it goes in organized crime circles. It's very political.
And is it true, Andrew, that if you're too good at your job, if you're a street guy, but you're so proficient at your job, that sometimes that can be costly to you, too, because then your boss might think, geez, this guy's pretty sharp. Maybe he wants to wear my hat one of these days.
Without a doubt, it could be a very, very dangerous thing to be good at your job. And a lot of guys have died way before their time for being too good at their job in organized crime settings. Because although the bosses like the guys who bring in the money, and they like the guys who could produce for them, they also look at guys as competition after a certain standard is set, and they see that this guy's capable of doing that. You know, if a boss goes to prison and he knows that, you know, there's a good chance if he puts you in charge while he's away that he might not get his job back when he comes out, he's going to go to a less threatening force to take over for him, somebody who he can control to keep the money within his own personal family. That's the way that works. So the guy who really deserves it gets overlooked in organized crime. I mean, it's just, you know what, Dennis, just a story, like right now you see all the politics that's going on in the world today with the elections coming up and everything like that. Organized crime makes that look like romper room. It really makes it to look to be a joke, you know? I mean, you got nepotism, you got favoritism, you have, you know, guys getting inducted in families that don't belong only because they're related. You know, they really don't have the street savvy or the respect of other guys within the family to take over that position, you know. And then basically, how can I explain it? Basically, that's how the links in the chain wind up getting weak over the years, is exactly what we just touched on the last minute and a half or 2 minutes. But you know what, Dennis? I'm lucky to be able to tell my story. A lot of time has passed. You know, now we're on to doing other things. As you know, me and you did many of, speaking engagements in the public sector, you know, trying to get the word out there about, you know, the pitfalls of organized crime activities to the younger generation so that, you know, they don't make the same mistakes that me and other guys like me have made. And Now I'm trying to do some things with schools. If I can hopefully get our foot in the door to do some school activities, whether it's the criminal justice classes and stuff like that, that really interests me. So hopefully I'll be ringing you up on the phone and maybe we could do this in the future.
Well, that would be great, Andrew, because, you know, I think there were the younger people, there's a lot of misconceptions, and I think a lot of them see the Hollywood version of organized crime, or the life, as it's called, and think of the, you know, the money in the pocket, fancy cars, good clothes, all that kind of stuff. And they don't, I think, understand what it's really about. And when we worked together on your book, Surviving the Mob, it was I've thought about it during the writing and frequently afterward about that isn't the kind of life most people would knowingly, if they understood it and understood what was ahead of them, would not want to live that kind of life, never knowing when the guy you think's your best friend is going to take you out for a walk and put one in your head.
Without a doubt, Dennis. I mean, especially like today, you know, the way they sell it as, you know, this honorable society. They sell it as this, you know, one for all for one, you know, lifestyle, and it's not. It's just very cutthroat, you know, and, you know, when you go to jail, your family's left alone, unless you're very, very fortunate. You got to be very fortunate for somebody to actually look out for you in today's mafia world. I mean, other than that, your wife's going to be on welfare. We spoke about this time and time again. But that's how they sold it to the young kids growing up, because that's the brainwashing mechanism, Dennis. You know, you're going to be a part of something great. And look, all human beings want to be a part of something. You know, if you look at any regular Joe off the street, everybody would love to be a part of something, you know. You know, I'm not saying that they'd want to be part of a crime family, so to speak, but everybody likes to get accepted and have the friends that they can count on or think they can count on or be a part of something that they feel is great. And as I was growing up in the street, that's what I thought. I thought I was going to be a part of something great, that we had all the answers. You know, I felt bad for regular people. I thought regular people were silly. Like, how did they not see it? Like, but I didn't get to see the ill parts of it until I started to really to my crime started to progress. And then it was welcome to the world. This is what it is, kid. And seeing many of my friends die way before their time, you know, going to jail and realizing that when you go to jail, you're left alone, seeing other friends of mine get life sentences and knowing that, you know, people might care. You might see a few people, you know, send you a few cards here and there when you first go away. But 15, 20 years in, nobody cares anymore, Dennis. That's the whole sad reality of it. All they want to do is they put somebody else in your place, somebody else to produce, and if he goes, then they'll put somebody else in his place. It's never ending.
So it's all about the money.
Exactly. I mean, generation after generation in my neighborhood, they should do a survey about the knock-around guys in my neighborhood, Dennis, alone, and they could see how many generations of kids from my neighborhood life were ruined by thinking they were going to be a part of this great entity. Really. You know, and everybody thinks they're going to be the exception. I thought I was going to be the exception. I thought I was smarter than everybody else. Hell no, I ain't smarter than everybody else. What happens is maybe 1% of the guys who are out there doing the dirt actually have a happy ending and say, okay, well, you know what, I can reap the rewards of the money I stole and this, this. Every other story you hear is a horror story. Guy doing 100 years, the guy doing 90 years, the guy found in the trunk of his car, a guy found in the street, a guy on the run for all his life. I mean, basically, you know, there's no good retirement package there, you know. Working a regular job, Dennis, making minimum wage, if you think about it, you know, at least the retirement's a lot better. You might not be making the big bucks. You might not be driving a fancy car, but, you know, you don't have to worry about the hinges coming off your door at night, and you don't have to be worried about getting shot by a guy who you thought was your friend.
You know, Andrew, you just made an interesting point here a little bit ago, and I remember when I started becoming interested in mob stories and the mafia back in, more years ago than I care to count, and at the time, you were going back, and it wasn't all that long after guys like, you know, Capone and the so-called mustache Pete's of the old mafiosi type, And there was a lot of books being written about them, you know, in the 50s and 60s, because most of those guys were then gone or in prison or whatever. And
yeah,
that was the story that I always told about how, oh man, this great entity, as you call it, of organized crime, and if anything happens to the street soldier, you know, the boss is right there with his wallet open, and you know, everybody's going to eat well while the guy's in jail, and they're going to pay lawyers' costs and all this stuff, and there's nothing to worry about. We take care of our own and all that shit. And
no, without a doubt. Never
maybe
happened.
It was,
I mean,
like that at one
but
point.
Very, yeah, because it was a different lifestyle back then. And you know what? You know, it was a different lifestyle, but still it was about money then as well. But you know what? As the generations changed, so did the mindset. And when the mindset changed, and now look, instead of a boss ingratiating a guy who was a big earner, in today's mafia, they look to kill you to take your money away from you. There's a difference. You know, a lot of guys got killed because they had big, big money. The bosses weren't even making as much money as some of the underlings, and the bosses wanted to get their hands on the money. The only way they could do that is to find a way to make everybody around think that this guy was no good. So guys got labeled being no good who were really solid guys. But the boss wanted your money, and there's nothing that you're going to do about it. And so what they do is they set a rumor in place to say that you're X, Y, and Z. And next thing you know, everybody's following what the boss is doing, and there's so many people grateful to do a favor for a boss than is thinking that they're going to get a leg up. And all the boss sees when you do that sees that you can't be trusted as well, because if you could throw your best friend under the bus or your relative or your uncle or your cousin or your brother, then the boss knows he can't trust you either. They don't realize that that's a double-edged sword. But they're so blinded by, you know, showing their loyalty that they don't realize that they just showed their whole hand, you know, and the boss sees it. At least a smart boss would see it, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, years ago, I grew up with, you know, looking at the guys from my, you know, from who were older than me, a generation older than me, and looking at them like they were celebrities. You know, there's no heroes here. You don't find that out until you actually go to jail and, you know, you spend some time with a lot of these guys and realize that these guys, some of them, not all of them, because there are some guys there that were real ballsy guys. There were guys there that, you know, they lived by this life and, you know, and they don't care what. They're going to go down with the ship and this, that, the other thing. But you know what? Their mindset, what? I mean, to throw your life away for other people who really don't care about you and they're going to use you up and spit you out. I never, you know, listen, I was one of those guys then who drank the Kool-Aid. I would have definitely did whatever they asked of me. But, you know, you can't want to kill me. And then, you know, after it's over, say, oh, okay, yeah, listen, bygones be bygones, but I still want you to protect me now. You know I want to hurt you, but listen, I don't want you to hurt me in any sort of way now. I mean, basically, that's what it is. But see these guys in action, when you're doing time with them, you realize that a lot of these guys were just a shell of their reputations. And that's where I started to see the downfall, where guys that I looked up to my whole life and then realized that these guys didn't have the balls they were born with. And I realized that, you know why, it was 85% bullshit, 15% you know, action. And the guys who were doing the 15% action was guys like me and other guys from the crew in the street who were actually out there doing people's bidding for them. You know what I mean? So I got to see a side of it that not too many people, I don't wish too many people to see that side of a life. I'm just fortunate enough to be able to tell the story. And because it's going to turn out a lot different for me right now. As we both know, Dennis, from you did my story, you know that I'm a very lucky man to be here, to even be able to remotely have this conversation. So knowing so, I feel as though to pass it down, to try to help somebody for the future. Listen, you're not going to change the world, but if one kid from the neighborhood sees it for what it really is, then at least that's one kid that don't have to, you know, find out down the line that he was sold a bill of goods and thinking that, you know, he was going to, you know, how can I say it, you know, discover something great, you know.
And Andrew, you're speaking about you realizing how lucky you are to be able to tell your story, to be here. It not only was were you the subject of a hit, a potential hit by by organized crime. In fact, a couple of organized crime families. But you were able to avoid that and ended up cooperating with law enforcement and turned your life around from what it could have been. But, you know, even that, the legal end of it, the law enforcement end, you were involved in several shootouts and shooting incidences. And one of them, it's still incredible to me, you know, how this guy didn't do it, just like an act of God that this guy didn't die. And you came close a few times to killing someone, but for some kind of, I call it divine intervention, where the bullet strikes a bone and veers off.
Well, you know what? It just was meant to be. Exactly. And I think about that a lot. And you know what, Dennis? And I'm grateful for that. Because, you know what, at least I can move on and I know that, you know, I did a lot of bad things in my life and I'm not proud of them. I did, you know, I was involved in every aspect of organized crime activity. And, you know, but I don't have to carry it with me for the rest of my life. And I could put it behind me to some extent. I'll never forget because I have to have a healthy respect for the life that I did live because that keeps me alive today. It keeps me sharp. I still live by the same standards, but a lot of guys can't turn that off. A lot of guys, you know, they weren't as fortunate as I was, you know, as far as that's concerned. And, you know, so I know that must be hard on them. I can't speak for them, of course, but it is. I don't want to say it is what it is. I don't want to be so cavalier to say that, Dennis, but it's a horrible life. It really is. It's a horrible, horrible life. And, you know, like I said, there's no heroes. There's no, you know, there's no star-studded appearance by people who, you know, could make the world change for you. It's just a bunch of guys who stick together to try to rob as much as they can and try to help each other not get locked up. Basically, that's what it is. And, you know, we used to scheme from the minute we woke up to the minute we went to sleep. And outside their club doors, everybody was a victim. Dennis, the guy down the block, your old next-door neighbor, whoever it was, they were all a victim, if so be it. And that's the sad part. People you went to school with or grew up with, there was no honor or loyalty to them. If your boss said that they had something that he wanted, they were had. That's the way it was. And, you know, so go right ahead, sir.
Before we move on, I want to talk about the mob museum in a second. But before we do that, there's two things I want to ask you. First of all, did you have a favorite crime? In other words, was robbery, was, you know, running the horse parlors, the illegal gambling? Did you have a favorite of all the different crimes you committed that you liked the best?
You know what my favorite crimes were, Dennis? The ones I got away with. I mean, basically, that's what it is. It's the one you get to, it's the ones you get away with that are ones that are your favorites. I mean, listen, it's all negative stuff. No matter what, when you think back upon it, I mean, thank God, like I said, we could tell the story and we could have a few tips on it, but there's no laughing matter. I mean, basically, just the ones that you got away with was enough. But, you know, I like to think that what they call an all-purpose organized crime guy, where I was capable of doing any and all things if the boss needed me to. And I think that's what I wanted to be known as, somebody who could be called upon to do just about anything. And little did I know that it was only going to be detrimental to me. It was never going to be anything to get me anywhere, you know. And but when you're young and, you know, you grow up with this set of standards, you know, it takes a lot of years and a lot of bumps in the road to realize that you're living an ill life, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, I wanted to mention, talk about the mob museum. Before we do that, Kim, do you have anything you'd like to ask Andrew?
Well, I would like to say hello to Andrew. It's so nice
Hi,
to
Kim.
Have you
How
on
you?
The show. I'm really
Thank
good.
You.
Thank
Thank
you.
You. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And I don't have anything off the top of my head that I'd like to ask you. I mean,
that's fine. Don't worry about it. The less questions, the better off we are in life. Don't worry about it. But listen, Dennis, you know, you got an interesting story. We were just talking about Frank a few minutes ago, and I'm going to listen in because I definitely want to hear Frank's story. I want to hear that story. I want to hear it from him. I think that's real interesting, knowing that what your past working with those guys from who do all of that paranormal stuff.
Yes, that's going to be interesting.
I'm definitely going to listen to it. Now, I don't know what time it is, Dennis, but I know if Frankie's due to come on, right?
He should be joining us in about 5 minutes or so.
Okay.
Andrew,
go right ahead.
Now, in February, on Valentine's Day, in fact, in Las Vegas, they opened the, I guess the full name is National Museum of Organized Crime and Law Enforcement. Or
yeah.
Law Enforcement and Organized Crime, but better known as the Mob Museum. And you came into town for the opening. And, in fact, you were participating in a video that's shown in the museum and so on.
Yeah.
And
yes.
I just wanted to get your thoughts on the museum, because there was a lot of controversy that some critics were saying, well, you shouldn't glamorize organized crime, and this would be, you know, encouraging it,
there's nothing in the museum that does that. As a matter of fact, it's the exact opposite. What it does is it's a history lesson. And unfortunately for the United States and our history, organized crime was definitely a part of our history. And what it does is it shows the changes in generations of different types of organized crime and crime activity throughout the United States from early on up until recently. And but it also shows how law enforcement has grown from leaps and bounds. It shows their rise to handle what was thrown at them generation after generation. So it's really a really, really interesting school. It's a lesson to learn, I should say. I mean, I don't see why they don't have, like, school trips for older children, like older ones, to go there to see as far as, crime classes or, you know, criminal history or whatever it may be. I think everybody who goes there would actually walk out of there learning something. I don't see glamorizing anything. You know, there's no medals on the wall there. It's just actual artifacts of things that did happen in the past and in the future, you know, and in the current day. So I think they did a great job with the museum. I really do. As a matter of fact, I was fortunate enough to go there not too long ago. I got to see Jack Garcia, the FBI agent. I got to see him before he had his did one of the first speaking engagements there. They have these open speaking engagements. I think it's once a month now going on. I think the next one is going to be that Robert Blakely, the guy who actually had a hand in writing the RICO statute law for the federal government. And
yes.
So it's all interesting stuff. I mean, all very interesting. And I think once people go there, that would pretty much set the tone that they were given, you know, a big bill of goods here and that it wasn't something worthwhile. It definitely is. It really is.
And, you know, Andrew, what I think might cause some of that confusion is there's another mob exhibit, if you will, in Vegas, but it's a different thing. It's called the mob. What's it now? Mob Attractions. Had a couple of different names, and it's located at the Tropicana out on the Strip. The Mob Museum is located downtown in the old post office building, and it's actually the building where the Kefauver for organized crime hearings were held. It's quite a very historic location.
Yeah,
but I've never been to the Tropicana.
Me neither. I've never been there. Me neither. I've never been to the Tropicana. I never went to their attraction or whatever it was. I was fortunate enough to do the museum twice, and both times it was very, very enjoyable. And me being around organized crime activity my whole life, you still walk out of there learning things that you really, you know, some things that you didn't know. I mean, you just realize that, you know, you realize that organized crime is just not, you know, just not in, you know, the U.S. or in New York, where I grew up, but it's everywhere. It was everywhere across the world, you know, in Europe and
yeah.
Asia, it's everywhere. And you get to learn about these different things.
And it's, I think the staff there, I've been very impressed with the staff. I mean, it's not only impressive to look at and walk through, but it seems to be in very good hands. I know the director, Jonathan Ullman, you and I both have worked with him, met him and worked with him. And
He's a gentleman,
and,
John.
And
he's
all
a real
the people
gentleman.
Are impressive.
Yeah, I mean, so, listen, basically they keep it fresh, they keep it good. You know, they're really setting the standard, you know, They're making it interactive for the public, where the public could actually, you know, go there and interact with these guest speakers. They could actually, you know, there's some attractions there where they could actually listen in on some FBI surveillance hearing devices and hear some old tapes that were taped years ago, I believe, on some of the John Gotti tapes and other organized crime figures. It's very, very interesting. It really, really is. And but, you know, it's not, I know it's not for everybody, but it's still a part of our history. So, you know, that's where people could still learn a lesson to know during their era or, you know, whatever era that they were born in or whatever, could see what was happening during that time period, you know, when it comes to organized crime. So, yeah, it's great. I mean, I wish
Well, very good, and I think I'm hoping we'll get to do some more stuff there. I know I'm looking forward to getting back in there, you know, again to do a book signing or whatever. It's just it's a great experience and a great crew to work with there.
No. It definitely was. So, like I said, Dennis, I'm going to listen in tonight. I want to hear Frankie. I want to hear about that. I didn't get to hear from him. I think I heard it from somebody else to tell me about it, but it sounds good. You know, I could see that happening. You know what I mean? I mean, that place has a lot of history.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it does. And but, I think Frank just is on the line with us now. So you going to listen in to our talk?
Well, yeah, I'm going to listen in. I'm going to put the thing on so I can listen to you guys. How you doing, Frank?
I'm doing good, Andrew. Doing good.
All right. Listen, guys, have a good night. All right? I'll speak to you guys
Thanks
soon.
Thanks a million, Andrew.
All right. Good night.
Bye-bye. Our next guest is former Chicago Outfit Associate Frank Collada. Frank, welcome to CrimeWire.
Thanks for having me, Denny.
We've been talking to Andrew DiDonato here for the first half hour and talking about his experiences with organized crime in New York. And now you're a Chicago guy. And your affiliation and your start with the organized crime was in Chicago. And in Chicago, instead of like New York has these different families, the family there is known as the Chicago Outfit. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's it. That's what they call us, Chicago Outfit.
And that they had some very sharp bosses, I know. I mean, they've had a lot of sharp organized crime bosses in all over the country. Chicago had some, and one of the ones I read about quite a bit, who was apparently one of the best, was a guy named Tony Accardo.
And that's correct. He's the only one I ever know that never went to jail. Usually every boss throughout the country goes to jail. He never went to jail.
Yeah, and he died of old age, right? Natural causes?
Yeah, he died of natural causes. He died at home. I think he died of a heart attack or a stroke or something like that.
So that he's one of the few, if you want to call it the success stories, you know, that made it through, died in his own bed or whatever. Without spending any
jail. He's one of the lucky ones. success.
Frank, when you were just starting out, you were on the streets there. You were shining shoes, I believe, in Chicago, maybe Grand and Ogden, I think you might have been on. And you run into another kid also shining shoes there, and you guys got into a little dispute about whose turf that was, who was supposed to be working on that corner. Could you tell us who this other kid was that you met?
Yeah, his name was Anthony Spilaccio. Are you still there?
I'm still here.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I thought
I'm here, Frank.
Yeah, his name was Anthony Spilaccio, and we were about 16 months apart in age, and that's how we met. We were shining shoes in the same block, and he didn't like the idea of me being in his territory, and we got into a little bit of a pushing match and a little threat back and forth about who's going to be there tomorrow or if whoever's going to be there would have to fight and so on, all that nonsense. And I guess he told his brother about it, and his father overheard it, and his father asked him to find out if my father's first name was Joe. And when he found that out, he said, well, my father said that you and I got to be friends the rest of our life because your father saved my father's life from the Black Hand. And we became good friends, and Tony became, he always wanted to be a big outfit guy, a made man. And we did a lot of robbing together, a lot of different Muslim people and so on through our lifetimes. And he wound up becoming a made man with the Chicago outfit.
And the Black Hand, for people who don't know, that I believe, Frank, was an Italian crime operation.
Bunch of old greaseballs from Sicily, they came down here and they muscled their own kind because they knew their own kind were a bunch of immigrants and weren't going to run to the police. So they were able to muscle them out of either their earnings, whether they owned grocery stores or whatever they owned. These greaseballs would put the muscle on them. And that's what they tried to do to Tony's father. He owned a restaurant.
So you and Tony ended up then becoming friends when you realized your father's knew each other and stuff, and you did a lot of work together. But Tony, like you said, wanted to become a made man and a big outfit guy. You never really wanted to do that, did you? You kind of wanted to stay independent.
Yeah, I always wanted to stay independent. My father was always independent also, but yet we were connected to the outfit, you know. And, I mean, I could have told anybody I was a made guy and they would have believed it, but there's no sense for me to lie about something like that. I wasn't a made man. I was connected to the outfit like anybody is when they socialize with these people. You're automatically connected, especially if you're out robbing and you're kicking in a percentage of what you're stealing. You know, you get favors too out of them. So, yeah, I was always hooked up with them probably since I've been 18 years old.
And these... But as an adult, Frank, after you turned 16, can you tell us about the time you were picked up by the Chicago police and taken up to the 11th floor, I believe, and interrogated up there?
I was older than that. Yeah, I was older than that. I think I was probably somewhere around near my 20s, somewhere 18, 19, somewhere in there. Yeah, we got a bum beef for a stick-up bank messenger, had a bag of money, and we were just laying on the guy. And the guy seen us walking under a viaduct, in case any of you don't know what a viaduct is, that's an overpass. We were under, and in Chicago they call them viaducts, and we were walking underneath it, and the guy just happened to be coming the other way. It's like a closed tunnel, and he looked at us and just threw the bags of money and ran. And, of course, we picked up the money then and left. And we bent the plates on the car and all of that, because we didn't go there with the intentions of robbing him. We were just went there to lay on the guy and probably get him in a week or two. And a couple days later, I got arrested by the detectives, Mike Gargano and Dursky. I can't even think of his freaking screwy name right now, Durso. Anyway, they took me up to the 11th floor, and they give me a beating, a severe beating while I was in the chair. They hit me on the head with phone bugs, put the cattle prongs on my testicles. Their boss came to the room. His name was Frank Tate. He was known as a killer that killed many thieves. And he said, well, throw the guy out the window if you don't want to talk. So I was still handcuffed and back while they were beating me. And I figured, well, it's all over. And I said, they hung me out of the window. But I had a funny feeling I wasn't going down because the cuffs were still on me. And anybody in their right mind would know that a guy ain't going to jump 11 stories with his hands cuffed behind him. So they finally pulled me back in the window, and then about a half hour later, Frank Tate came in the room. He told him guys to bring me to his office. He asked me if my father was Joe Collada, and I said, yeah. And then he says, you'll never be the man. You'll never, if you're trying to be the crook your father was, you'll never be. And he went on and on. So then these two cops walked me down. I had a Cadillac convertible at the time, and they were walking me down to the garage. They had my car in their garage. I thought for sure I was going to get whacked. But on the way down there, Durso said to me, meet Mike tomorrow and give him some money. We want $3,000. So Mike told me where he wanted to meet, and the next day I gave him $3,000, and that squashed that deal.
But didn't you run into him later, a few years later, in prison?
Yeah, I ran into both of them in prison. As it was, one was a cop, and one hung with the cop. Thurston was the cop, and Gargano hung with him. I met him in Stateville Penitentiary, and Gargano was a good guy, you know. And they were in there for killing a dope dealer. drug dealer for not paying his dues to them. And I told Gargano, I says, you're going to get a pass in there. I said, but he's not going to get a pass. And he didn't beg me, he just asked me, please don't, you know, kill him or anything like that. I said, no, he's just going to get a beating. So the following day, they have tunnels in there in a prison. As he was coming down the hall, I just come out from around a corner and I whacked him in the face with a chair and I kept on beating him. And they had no cameras in jail at that time and walked away and that was it. Got even.
So you got a little bit of payback for that deal on the 11th floor.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it wasn't worth killing because it would have just gave me more time.
Yeah, and you met somebody while you were in Stateville, I think, a guy named Newman?
Yeah, Larry Newman worked for us after he got out of Stateville. Larry and I worked in a psychiatric division at a penitentiary for the criminally insane. And whoever came up there, they were criminally insane or they were baby rapers. Well, needless to say, if you were a child molester or whatever, you probably didn't leave out of there walking. You usually went on a bag or something. And I met this Larry Newman in there, and he worked directly for the psychiatrist. Man had a genius of an IQ, and we became good friends. He was in there for a triple murder at 125 years. And he did 11 years at it. And when he got out of jail, he hooked up with me in Illinois. And then I took him to Vegas with me.
Newman, actually, he wasn't one of these guys that had to commit crimes because he was destitute and couldn't afford food or anything. He actually was getting some kind of a payment or an endowment or something through his father. I guess his father had left him some money. So
He left him a trust fund. I think it was like for $8,000 or $7,500 every 2 months he would get a check. And back then, that's pretty good money, you know, back then.
Sure.
But it was and he couldn't take all the money out. It was in there, and if he died, it would go to a cancer research. So, because his father knew the way he was, you know. So
yeah.
He didn't really need to rob or hurt anybody. He had plenty of money.
But he just liked it.
He loved it. He was like no different than a serial killer.
Frank, after you got out of prison, while you were in prison, let me put it that way, Tony Spilotro, who you would, you know, were friends with, had been sent to Las Vegas to kind of keep an eye. Tony at that point was a made man. He was an outfit guy. And they sent him there because they were they had the hidden ownership and control over some of the casinos in Las Vegas, and they were headquartered out of the Stardust at that time. And after you got out of prison, Tony invited you to come join him there, and you said no initially. You were going to try your hand in Chicago for a while, but after a few years,
I got out of prison in 1974, so I couldn't go to him before that. Because I did six years in prison. But when I got out, I opened up a couple places, and Tony come and see me a few times, and he says, why don't you move out to Vegas with me? He says, you know, and I said, hey, I don't want to move out there, you know. And he said, well, you know, you got the okay to come out there. And finally, in 1970, I think I moved out there in late 78 or early 79, He called, got a hold of me again, and he asked me to come out there. He says he definitely needed me. He wouldn't ask me if he didn't need me. So I packed my bags, and I went to Las Vegas, and I asked him what my functions would be. And he told me more or less it would be to make sure that if there was any cheaters in the casino, and he named the casino host and managers that would get a hold of me, and they would tell me who the cheaters are. If there were people we knew, let's say, you know, guys that should know better.
Uh-huh.
And I was the one that was supposed to straighten them out because Tony couldn't go into casinos. He was 80. He was in a black book. Plus,
right.
I had the power to get anybody jobs in these four casinos. I mean, they knew who I was as soon as I walked in the door. And if I needed to get somebody a job in there, as long as they had experience, you know,
yeah.
would the cards or the dice, then they would hire him. Plus, I would get people rooms in there. It was all, you know, taking favors from people in Chicago or any high roller. We make sure we took care of. And that was in watching Lefty Rosenthal's back, who was in charge of the casino at the time. He didn't own it, or he just was a front man in there. He was a numbers man.
And let me say for the listener now, if what you're hearing the last minute or two sounds familiar, that scenario was what was dramatized in the 1995 movie Casino. And in that movie, Joe Pesci played a character based on Tony Spilotro, and Robert De Niro played a character based on Lefty Rosenthal, and character actor Frank Vincent played the role of Frankie, and Frankie was actually based on you, wasn't it, Frank?
Yeah, that's true. You know, I mean, they could. Frank Vincent's part was fairly strong, but he couldn't be, you know, his part couldn't be as strong as Pesci and De Niro, because they were
right.
Genuine stars of the show. So he had to just more or less stand back. And in reality, I was a lot stronger than the way Frank Vincent portrayed me in the movie.
And the
you were
a consultant who served as a technical consultant to the movie.
Oh yeah, I was I did much work with Nicholas Pileggi. He was the writer of the movie, and we did a lot of work together on that. So when it all came down to the finding out if they were going to go with it, the movie stars, even. Then I asked them if I could play a part in a movie, and they all agreed. When I say all agreed, that's De Niro, Pesci, Sharon Stone, and Martin Scorsese and Nick Pileggi. We were all in a suite together discussing this, and I said, "Aren't you worried?" I looked at Robert De Niro. Aren't you a little worried somebody might try to hit me in the head on the set? He's, "No, I got nothing to worry, but you got to worry, not me." So I laughed at that, and I went on the set, and I sat next to Martin Scorsese through the whole film and more or less told him what I thought was right and what was wrong. And that's the way we did the movie. And then I did my parts in the movie, you know.
And you were played a hitman in what, 6 or 7 murders, I think there were, weren't there?
Well, yeah, there was, I forgot how many there were in the movie, but I think there was 1, 2, 3, 4 that I had to participate in the movie. And one of the hits in the movie was an actual hit I performed on the streets when I was free.
And that was the one, I think in the movie they said it was in Costa Rica, but you actually did that one in Las Vegas.
Yeah, we did that in Las Vegas. They had to make it look like the guy run off to Costa Rica with some money. And scene is us chasing him around the house, and then me shooting him outside by the waterfall. Actually, I shot him inside and threw him in a pool.
And I think Nick Pileggi said at one point it was the first time in all his career he's ever had a real-life hitman recreate a murder on the screen.
Yeah, I keep on hearing that from them, so evidently it must be true. Everybody tells me that.
Hey, Denny, we do have a caller on the line who has a question for Frank.
Oh,
great.
Good
you
for
want
him.
To bring him on?
Okay,
yeah.
I'll bring him on. This is Mike, our friend from Canada. Mike,
hey,
go ahead.
Hey, Denny, how's it going?
Good, Mike. How you doing?
Good. I haven't talked to you for a while, and it's great to have Frank on the show. And I don't know if he remembers me or not. I met him down in Las Vegas a couple of times at the opening of the museum. I was a friend of Henry's and Andrew's and Denny's there. And
I'm sure I did.
And I think, as I say, I met you met you down there, and then one time you and some of the fellows were over at breakfast over at Peppermills there. I met you there and had a picture taken with you there.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I remember you now.
Yeah, exactly. I was kind of involved with, we had a little ceremony for myself there
right.
with the boys.
He got married or something, or somebody was getting married, was that it? Or
No, I was with I was the first made man of the
Right, that's what it was.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about a fellow that was kind of the downfall of everybody, Sal Romano. And
yeah.
I wanted to ask, why in the world, as paranoid as Tony was, you know, he was quick to put hit on people. Even when you went with him, with your suspicions, and you even had somewhat proof, why was that
well,
he was an informer? Why did Tony protect him?
I know what you're saying. First of all, Tony's excuse was, well, listen, I had the guy alarm my house. Sal was good with alarms, and he let Sal alarm his house. He says, and if the guy would have put a bug, I would have known about it in my house. He's the guy solid. I think that Tony was thinking dollar signs all the while. His greed that made him make that decision. You know, when you're looking at $1 million in jewelry and money, and Tony was sort of like falling on hard times at the time, as quite as it was kept, because he had a bad habit too. So he refused to, and I wanted to pass on a score many times, as you well know. It's in my book.
Exactly, yeah.
I didn't trust Sal Romano from the first day I met him. I get good gut feelings about people. And if I'm left alone, I follow my gut feeling, I wouldn't have got busted like that. None of us would have, you know. I'd have just passed on and done it next year.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess that's what the greed of the money, all Tony could see was the money, and he would take a chance on it. And
Mike, I was visited by two Chicago detectives. They come out from Chicago to tell me. Two detectives.
And they told me,
they said, don't trust this guy, Sal Romano. I said, I don't trust him. They said, we're just giving you some advice. We busted him at O'Hara Field with a load of furs, mink coats, and the FBI took the case over. And he hasn't been tried since. There's not even a docket on it. That tells me everything I need to know right there.
Well, exactly. And as I say, it was kind of unfortunate for everybody that Tony didn't follow your advice, I guess. And I guess the rest is history.
Yeah, it is. Tony screwed up.
And one more quick thing there, when you mentioned Larry Newman. I think, I think that was the only guy that I could, I've read the book several times and talked to a few people, and I think that was the only man that Tony was a little nervous about. You know, he wasn't afraid of him, but I think he was a little leery of him because he liked his job, and you never know what he was really thinking, I guess. Would that be correct, Frank, a little bit?
Yeah, Tony was really scared of him. Tony had told me one time, he said, whatever you do, don't stick the big guy on me. And that meant Larry.
Yeah, and he would have been
Larry about had. Larry was a big guy. He was about 6'2". The guy used to do 1,000 sit-ups a day.
Wow.
And he was in very good physical shape.
Because I remember when he asked you to do the hit with the listener hit, he wanted his wife gone too. He'd be glad to do them both.
Oh, yeah, you got a good memory. Yeah, he said, let me do them both. And I said, Tony don't want you on it, period. As a matter of fact, he wants you just to hang around with the guy and make him like him. He says, no, I want to kill her. He says, that's the one I really want to kill. So I can't stand her. So I said, nah, he says, you can't go on him. Oh, he was a violent guy.
Exactly,
He was a violent, violent guy. You'd never know if he was going to get you. He wouldn't get mad in front of you. He'd walk around, walk out, come back and shoot you.
Yeah, no, it was like, well, that's interesting. That was the only guy that Tony was really, really leery of. And but anyway, it's great talking to you, Frank, and once again, you, Denny, and we'll hopefully meet up again someday down in Vegas or somewhere. Is there?
All right, man.
Well,
my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Mike, and listen in to the next couple of minutes here. We got some breaking news.
I sure will. Yeah, Denny, I'll be right here.
Breaking news.
Thanks. Frank, we just got a few minutes left, and I can't wait to ask this question or talk about this. Now, I've known you a few years now. I know your history, you know, what the different things you've done in your life and what some of the stuff you've been through, and there's no question you're a tough guy. You've done most of it. You've seen most of it, and you and I had a conversation a couple of weeks ago. And you said to me, you said, did I tell you what happened to you when I was in Vegas for the Henry Hill Memorial Dinner? And I said, no. And you told me about something that happened to you at the Las Vegas Hilton, or the former Las Vegas Hilton. Could you go ahead and tell the listeners what went down?
I'll tell them. It actually wasn't for Henry's memorial. It was a film festival, festival. I went in, and I got in a little early to check in, and the time to check in is 3 o'clock. So they said, well, we don't have any room. Oh, and the guy says, we have this one room. I said, is it a smoking room? He says, yeah. And I said, okay. And he didn't tell me it was a large room. And then I said, it's a large room. And I said, okay, I'll take it. It was a camp, you know. So I go up to the room. It's 477. So I walk in, and I'm in the room a little while. It's cold as hell in this room. So then I get a knock on the door, and I look, and it's Tony Montana. He had been down in the lobby when I went up. And he said, man, it's cold in here. And I said, yeah, I know. The steel was freezing. Everything was freezing. So there's two units in there. It was a huge. It was a suite. So we shut off both units, and we sit there a little while. And I said, man, it don't seem to be getting any warmer. And it was like 110 outside, but it was still freezing in there. So I said, by the time I get back to the room later, it should be warmer. So we leave, and we do our business, whatever we're going to do. So I get back to the room around 11:45. It's still cold. And I said, wow, this is crazy. And I had a cup of coffee I brought up, you know. So I said, well, I'm going to go to bed. I got to get up early. So I jump in this bed, and I said, man, it's nice and comfortable, I'm thinking to myself. I shut all the lights off. Funny thing is, when I walked in the room, the TV was off, and I know I left the TV on. And I said, well, maybe the maid come in and shut it off. So I'm laying in bed, and I fall asleep, and I'm not sleeping that long. And let me tell you something, people. I don't believe in ghosts. I never believe in ghosts in my life. If anybody told me there was ghosts, I'd tell them they're goofy. Well, I believe in ghosts now, all right? I'm not ashamed to say it either. I felt something pushing on my arm and neck, my side of my arm and neck. I was sleeping on my side, into my mattress, and I was starting to smother me. And I started to resist, and it was very hard. And finally, I bounced out of that bed. Now, I don't usually get out of bed too fast, but I was out of that bed in a fighting stance because I actually thought somebody was in the room with me. And there was nobody there. And then it got warm in the room, and I put the lights on, and I'd see nobody. And I said, this is crazy. So I said, how am I going to sleep in here? So I left every light on, put the TV on, and laid there in that bed with my eyes wide open for the next 4 hours. The next day, I had to meet somebody that's got a tour bus company out there that I give information to how to do his tour, map tour guides. And I told him, I said, Robert, I said, man, did I have a crazy experience last night? I said, I don't believe him. And I told him, he said, do you know that we do a tour over here? It's haunted? I said, you're kidding. He said, no. Well, I tell you, when I come back there that night, I walked up to the registration desk. I says, I ain't going to that room. I told it to them. They didn't look very surprised at me. And they put me in another tower. I didn't care if they put me in a closet. There was no way I was going to that room at 477. So I definitely believe there was somebody in that room.
You now believe in ghosts?
Oh, absolutely. I don't believe they travel around. I believe they're in certain locations, you know, because he sure didn't follow me to another room. You know, that's the hotel Elvis Presley used to stay at, not all the time, and the colonel stood in the suite over there. So who knows, it might have been his suite.
Well, at one time, didn't you have dinner with Priscilla Presley?
Yeah, I sure did. I sure did, absolutely.
Maybe Elvis was kicked off. But
I didn't
Frank,
think of it that way, but I hope he was.
Well, that is an absolutely great story. And, you know, if it came from anybody else, I might not believe it, but I know you, and I you know, if you say it, you're willing
to
admit it.
There's no reason for me to lie. There's no reason for me to lie about that. You know, I don't care if you believe it or not. But that's the experience I had. I know one thing. I'll never go on 477 again. You can bet on that.
Well, Frank, on that note, we're out of time. Listen, thanks a million for coming on tonight. We really appreciate your sharing your time with us.
All right, my pleasure, Denny.
Okay, Frank. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
My thanks again to tonight's guest, Andrew DiDonato and Frank Collada. Thanks also to the Crime Wire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, who also manned the switchboard for us, and public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, October 2nd. Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Denny Griffin and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night. Good night, Kim.
Good night, Denny. Thanks, Frank. Thanks, Andrew. And thanks, everybody in the chat room. Love you guys.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.